It's time for The Local Take with Kiplin Primus. The Local Take is all about community engagement, connecting our listeners with our community, and featuring people who don't always get media coverage, but who have important stories to tell. Now here's Kiplin Primus with The Local Take.
Good morning, good people. This is Kiplin Primus, and welcome to The Local Take. We're talking with Isabel Wilkerson, the award-winning author of Warmth of Other Suns, which is a book about the great migration of African Americans at the turn of the last century. Hello, Isabel. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, great. Great to be here.
And we're talking with her today because we're in this period of time where we're celebrating a lot of commemorative dates. 50 years ago, within the Civil Rights Movement, we had the anniversary of Medgar Evers' execution, the Birmingham Church being bombed 50 years ago. Last year was 50 years of the Freedom Riders. And we're also in that period where we're 150 years from when our nation was raging in a civil war. And it just has come to me over the last few months and the things that we've been discussing that not a lot has changed, or has it? Which is why I wanted to talk to you, Isabel, because you're a historian. You wrote this award-winning, wonderful book that everyone should get, Warmth of Other Suns. And it talks about what was happening at the turn of the century for the African-American community. And in some ways, it seems as if we're still there. In 1919, the NAACP was marching because of murders of African-American men. The last few months, people have been marching because of the murders of African-American men, from Trayvon Martin to Oscar Grant, Troy Davis, on and on and on and on. So has it really changed? What has changed? Can we change?
Well, I think that when you look at, first of all, I'm so delighted to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I think when you look at the history of African Americans in this country, you realize that from the arrival of the very first people who would ultimately be enslaved, there's been this effort to be free. And the Great Migration, which is the source of the, which is what my book is about, is really about the desire to be free. And so at each point in our history, people have done whatever it took to be free. And I think that when we get to a certain point, we believe that we have arrived, and then we look and we get reminders that we haven't. And what I'm thinking about at this time is about how of Dr. King's quote about justice and the moral arc of justice. And so he said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And when you think about that, it's a reminder that when we have made progress in this country, we often make 10 steps forward and then 9 steps back.
It seems like it's 10 steps forward and 15 steps back.
It may feel that way, but I think that right now, I think that we're at a real turning point in our country's history. And we have these turning points periodically. You know, the start of this year, we were celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. And the Emancipation Proclamation was the beginning of opening up the freedoms for people who've been enslaved. And yet, it didn't actually free anybody, as we know. And in fact, we celebrate in every June, we celebrate Juneteenth, which was the time when the last slaves found out 2 years late
that they were actually free.
So when you put in the mindset of what does freedom mean and what does it take to get there, I think that we have to be very open in what freedom means, because we've been challenged to find ways to be free even in difficult times. So what I'm getting at is, when you look at the progress that we've made, we have these spectacular moments of great progress. Emancipation Proclamation,
Reconstruction,
the 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment, first, freeing the slaves, freeing people who had been enslaved, and giving them rights of citizenship, and then allowing them to vote. And then you look at what happened during Reconstruction and all of this excitement that people had.
Senators, congressmen, black people were free, starting businesses, starting towns that were all black. Being successful.
And all of the colleges that were founded, all of the great colleges here in Atlanta and throughout other parts of the South, Howard University, Spelman, Morehouse, all of these schools, all this excitement of what was going to happen and, with this new possibility.
And then they sold us out and said the South could take back over, and Jim Crow came.
1896, Plessy versus Ferguson.
And things went like almost worse because you were kind of free, or they told you you were free, but your free was almost exactly what slavery was. Because you couldn't get ahead.
In fact, the point that you seem to be suggesting, and I would agree, is that, in fact, it has had a more dispiriting effect on African-Americans because there had been this hope that we had arrived. There was this hope that suddenly all of our hopes and dreams would come to reality now. Things have changed. Things have changed. Things
the law changed. We're here.
And yet what we find is that the country had not fully come to the point where it could allow the freedoms that we thought we would have. And I think that what you look at is you see that one of the reasons why, in my view, is because people don't really know the history, and we as a country have never dealt with the real issues that we have that the country has been through. In other words, we've never really dealt with the meaning of enslavement. We've never really dealt with what is the impact on those who were in the beneficiaries of it and those who were the victims of it. We've never really dealt with it. We've never had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We've never really sat down and addressed and dealt with the real impact on everybody, on the entire country, the economics of it, the psychology of it, the social impact of all these things.
The culture of it. Paula Deen story comes out of that racist past where black women were cooking, but white women were putting it on the table. They were the black people's recipes, but if a businessman got it and decided to franchise a chicken restaurant with a sandwich that his cook made, it wasn't hers, it was his. So this is, all of these things are part of our history that it seems like we conveniently forget. And no offense, but it seems like it's conveniently forgotten by Americans of the European persuasion more than other Americans. And that's why, to me, it seems like that conversation is so hard to have, because we can't have it truthfully.
We can't have it truthfully, partly because, and fully, partly because if this were happening in another country, people would be very quick to say, these are human rights abuses. How could this country allow this to happen to their people? But because we're talking about this country, and because we're talking about things that happen on this soil that involve people who are the descendants on all sides here, we've not dealt with it. It's like a family issue. It's a dysfunctional family that is not dealing with its problems when they sit down to dinner.
When you talk about the human rights issue, every year we get the human rights report around the world and China and everyone, China. We lock up more African Americans in this country now than we did in 1865. We stopped in 2011, New York stopped over 650,000 black men in stop and frisk. Most of the time, the reasons were looking furtive, moving uncomfortably. It's basically criminalizing
being black men.
How can Europeans in America look at that situation and embrace it? I mean, Mayor Bloomberg says there is no way they're getting rid of stop and frisk. How can he do that? When white people go to the airport and TSA stops and frisks them, it's on the news if it goes overboard. But they do it to black boys every day, 24/7. And I'm saying African-American men, but it happens to men, us too. Driving down the street one day, I was surrounded by four police officers. I was a black woman in a Ford Tempo. What could I have been doing?
You know, the thing about it is that because these issues and this essential history, the history of how we got to where we are has never been dealt with, things have not changed in the way people interact with one another in that subconscious assumption that's made about African Americans upon sight. That has not changed because we've never really addressed it as a country. People are not making the connection between how these things were in some ways the foundation of interaction between African Americans and others throughout from the beginning of the country, have not made the connection to how things occurred in the 1700s and the 1800s and the 1900s to what's going on now. Because these things have never been dealt with, they have not changed when it comes to the immediate subconscious reaction to dealing with people who look different from you. And that's what is undergirding all of this.
The stop and frisk laws that we live under are almost no different from the fugitive slave laws. Someone can stop you and ask you for your papers no matter where you are or what you're doing. How can we, as citizens of a country that's supposed to be founded on freedom, how do you mentally say that's all right for this subgroup of citizens?
Well, it's interesting you use the term subgroup, because the language of how we speak about African Americans is part of our challenge. In other words, it's not a subgroup. It's African Americans. They are Americans. We are Americans like anyone else. There's no African American history. It's American history. We are a cellular, part of this country's history.
It wouldn't be America without African Americans.
In fact, do you know that the three major city, the three biggest cities in this country, New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, were founded by people of African descent. Chicago was founded by John Point DuSable. And there's a DuSable High School. There's a DuSable Museum. It was founded by, he was of Haitian descent, and he actually put up the first trading post in Chicago. Near the Chicago River. And in New York, it was Jan Rodriguez, who was of African descent, had been abandoned by the Dutch sailors that had arrived there, abandoned, and they came back years later and found out that he set up a post in what is now Manhattan. And Los Angeles was actually founded by a group of about 40 people, among them people of African descent, who established a post in Los Angeles. So African Americans have been here for as long as there's been a United States of America.
So how did we get to the point where that was forgotten, or that isn't accepted even? Because I think that's what the question is. When do Black Americans get to have the full rights of freedom as citizens of the country?
That's really interesting you put it that way, because that's what I really believe is the big challenge. The big challenge is to be recognized as the citizens to which we have always been, and to be recognized for the contributions that we have made to this country. And that is that's the challenge of what, and the beauty of what you're doing. It's a challenge of what all of us do. A way to try to, affect the narrative of what's told in our country's, storytelling about itself, and how African Americans are embedded in that very story from the beginning until now. And first, we need to know our own history so that we can share it with others. And it needs to be incorporated as part of as what we view as being
part
American.
Of history.
In other words, to understand one's history and understand what it means to be American is to understand the African-American story.
You can't do it. And so when people say they're colorblind, I'm raising my children to be colorblind, not to see color. And then they wonder why we say, no, that's not correct. Can they understand that we have always been here, that it wouldn't be America without us? I have a house. I fly the American flag at my house. I have flown it at my house ever since I moved in, because I was raised to believe that this country would not be this country without my ancestors' sacrifice. So that I am entitled to everything this country has to offer simply because of that. Maya Angelou has a poem where she says, your success is already paid for. As African Americans in this country, your success is already paid for. You might have to struggle, you might have to work hard, but it is already paid for because we're in the blood and history of the country. But no one else seems to accept that. And then you have states like Arizona, where they're getting rid of the Latino education about the Latinos in their state, and it's with Mexico. I mean, don't they know that? Don't we realize that? Can we not consciously understand that everyone who is here, Asians, Japanese, Chinese, Korean, Jewish folks, Black folks, Mexican folks, we were all here at the beginning. We all contributed, and we all should have a right to the fruits and bounty of the country.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think one of the things I'd like to say, to put it in perspective, is that when you think about the, you know, our being in this country, on this soil, there are, in some ways, you know, very large epochs, I would say, that we've been part of. So there was enslavement, which went on for so long that it would take another 140 years for us to have been free longer than being enslaved. In other words, we were enslaved for longer than we have been free. And after the end of enslavement, you then had this long period of time of adjustment to what did freedom, so-called freedom, mean, and tremendous resistance on the part of non-Black people to people who've been enslaved moving into the larger society. And so you could see, when you look at it in a broad strokes of great passages of time, multiple generations, these things don't happen quickly. We wish that they would, and they should have happened quickly, but they haven't. And there's always been this resistance to, you know, our moving into the larger mainstream. So when you look at it, that's how I get into the migration, which is not about the Great Migration. It's about a search for freedom. And so what people did was, these people during this migration, which is what took up much of the last century,
right,
is that people, African-Americans who had been in the South, 90% of us were in the South at the beginning of the 20th century. By the time it was over, half were living all over the rest of the country. So this whole last century has been about forcing the country live up to its ideals of freeing African-Americans. That's really what it's about. So what did they do? They left. And when they left, they were in some ways fleeing a caste system. Mm-hmm. They were defecting from one part of the country to other parts of the country to become the citizens that they had had a right to be all along. So when we speak about like the last 100 years or so, it's been about a reshaping of ourselves into this larger society to compel the country to live up to its ideals. And so what they were fleeing was, they were fleeing a caste system.
And
we're still in a caste system. And the caste system was so arcane that it made it, you know, that for much of the time that we've been, you know, in this country, this is all fairly new. Freedom, as we know it, is fairly new. It's only 50 years old, if you think about it.
It really is only 50 years old. And I think sometimes when, you know, you have a slight at a grocery store at or a slight somewhere, and you go, you know, it's because I'm Black. And you think, no. You know, your forebears were picking 300 pounds of cotton and getting hit. The fact that they didn't cancel your manicure or wouldn't take your business, let's try to just move on. But in thinking about what you're saying, and I'm getting caught in this 50-year span.
Yeah.
Let's go further and just think for a minute. 100 years from now, an Isabel Wilkerson, who hasn't even been thought of today, is looking back at our time and is going to do exactly what you did and write about this time. What do you think they're going to say 50 years from now? What will she find?
I think that looking back from 50 years in the future, or 100 years in the future, I think that it will all be compressed into this period of time of searching. And trying to be free. In other words, I think that it will be viewed as a time that's a continuum of what went on during Plessy versus Ferguson, the retrenchment of against the freedoms and the effect that the search. I'm sorry. Let me start again. I think that it will be looked on as a retrenchment from the gains that had been made in the 1960s. In other words, it will be viewed as a feedback loop, as a kind of repeating of history again. I mean, that's one of the things that you look at where we are right now. In some ways, a lot of the answers are in history. What is it that happens whenever there's great strides made in this country by people who had been enslaved? and their descendants. What is it that happens in this country?
We always
and what happens each time is that there are great strides made as people, as people who value social justice move to the forefront and make things happen. And that's what we saw in the Reconstruction era.
That's what we saw from the 60s to now.
And that's what we saw in the 1960s until now. And we had these great strides that had as its pinnacle the election of a man of African descent at the pinnacle of that moment, 2008. And, you know, whenever there are great strides made, there is retrenchment, there's resistance, and there's an attempt to move backward. And that happens every single time. But in large spans of time, we're talking 100-year spans of time. What's interesting about the Voting Rights Act-ish situation is that it was the 15th Amendment that gave African Americans the right to vote, African American men the right to vote. And it took 98 years to actually enforce it, which is how we got the Voting Rights Act of 1965. What is it that happened to make that occur? That was decades of resistance, people fleeing the South, people marching, people expressing themselves in every possible way, deaths of people who were trying to register people to vote, Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner.
That was 50 years ago.
That was all of these things happening. And so then as a pinnacle of that, the result of all that was an actual Voting Rights Act that was essentially written, and it says it's written to enforce the 13th Amendment. So it took 100 years just to enforce what had been passed in the 1800s. And so that's only been, you know, that's been less than 50 years. That was 1965 that Lyndon Johnson signed that Voting Rights Act. And what is it that happened earlier this summer? In June, it was eviscerated by the Supreme Court. So you're talking this forward marching, making progress, and then this retrenchment, resistance, and turning back of the clock at each turn. And so then we have to start, gather ourselves again, and start anew.
So another, what do you think? At the turn of the last century, when the Great Migration started, Black folks were going all over the U.S. I was looking at a thing recently. There was a young woman in Florida. It was House Hunters International. She was moving to Ireland, had an Irish boyfriend, and she was going to Ireland. I've seen, you know, there was another one where a Black guy was going to Japan and acting in kung fu movies. Are we seeing that? Is that a trend? I tell young people all the time, go get out of the United States. You know, go to Brazil. Go somewhere else. Are we seeing that? I know at one point Blacks were moving back to the South. What is happening
What's
now?
Really interesting is that you see what is occurring. The migration ended in the 1970s. And this, it cannot be underestimated, the magnitude of this. I mean, 6 million people left the South to such a degree that it was a redistribution of an entire people. And after that ended, you know, that was the, all of these things culminated in the 60s and the 70s. All of these things, the marches, the protesting, Martin Luther King, Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner, all of these
things. The Freedom
Riders,
all of this stuff.
It took all of that, and this migration of all these people, it took all of that to get the civil rights legislation
passed
of the 1960s. It took everything in order for that to happen. And so then people felt it was safe to then return. Many people returned to the South. Some, you know, the majority of people who left did stay where they were. And then we find that much of what people were fleeing replicated itself throughout the entire country, such that, as you mentioned, Stop and Frisk is in New York. Rodney King was in Los Angeles. A lot of the, you know, issues, you know, of retrenchment and challenges that people have faced, there were riots in Chicago and in Detroit, race riots where African Americans were attacked. And so these things mean that this is an American challenge, not just a Southern challenge. And for African Americans, what does it mean when we are still searching for the inclusion into a country that we helped to build? What does it mean?
What does it mean? Honest and truthfully, that is the question. What does it mean? Because when you look even at African Americans moving back to the South, and I know the challenge of racism and racial challenges are everywhere. I know it's not just the South. But when you look at the red states being the slave states and African Americans moving back to the South, North Carolina just passed the most draconian voting rights laws. In Atlanta, you have political voice. But in the state of Georgia, there's not a whole lot that Democrats or African Americans can get done. How do African Americans come back to the South and find almost the same thing that they left? The Stand Your Ground law, where whites who shoot blacks in the Stand Your Ground law,
most of those are southern
get
states.
Off in southern states. But if a black person shoots a white person to say Stand Your Ground, they're going to jail. So that's when I say, does it change? You know, has it changed? Have we only taking the 10 steps forward and the 15 steps back?
Well, I always say 9 steps back because we're always making progress. And that arc of justice bends towards justice, but it's long and it's slow. And it may not be, you know, it's more of a, it's more like an EKG, you know, it's not a straight line. And that's one of the things that I think we would probably fare better if we recognize that too. You know, just spiritually, we would fare better if we recognize that it's not a straight line.
Okay.
And I think it's also a reminder that we should never get comfortable. I think it's a reminder that we are not there yet, and we don't know when we will be there yet, and that we cannot do it alone, and that that. This is not an overnight thing, but it is a long arc toward what we hope will be justice one day. And I think that's what Dr. King was speaking of. I think he recognized that it was going to take a long time, but that didn't mean that you give up, and it doesn't mean that you get comfortable, that it's you're constantly vigilant to what is necessary. I think it's the feeling too comfortable that actually sets us up for the shocking, the surprises about the Supreme Court ruling on this or some laws.
Zimmerman trial.
Zimmerman, all those things, is that we're always shocked and surprised. And I think that we would probably fare better if we recognize that this is a long journey toward where we want to be. And because the country's never really dealt with it, I think it's important for all of us.
We haven't even taken the first steps.
I think it's important for all of us to recognize the history and to know what it took for us to get here and to make it our job to make sure that our children know and that we are passing on the strengths of the ancestors to the next generation.
Well, Isabel, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning to talk about this. As you can see, it has been on my mind. And I think it's the conversation that we need to have in our community, outside of our community. Clearly, it's the conversation our country needs to have. So thank you so much for being here with us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
And everyone, go out, get Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. Thank you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Community Engagement on The Local Take with Kiplin Primus. The Local Take is a production of Jazz 91.9 WCLK Public Affairs. You can listen to this show on demand at our website at WCLK.com. If you have comments or suggestions for our program, please call us at 404-880-6211. The Local Take is produced by Kiplin Primus, Rob Maynard, and Marquis Lofton. Thanks for listening.